Nathan Hubbard. Spring has sprung, the birds are chirping, and the pop girls are pop girling.
Nora Princiati, the pop girls are girling. What does that even mean? You wrote this trailer. I do not talk like this, Nora.
But I try so hard to teach you.
Well, here's what I do know. This spring is packed with new releases from some of the biggest pop stars in the world, including our girl, Taylor Swift.
And every single album is back to cover it all.
We'll, of course, break down every angle on the Tortured Poets Department, out April 19th. But we'll also cover new music from Beyonce, Dua Lipa, Maggie Rogers, Kacey Musgraves, Ariana Grande, and whoever else just might surprise us this spring.
It's Pop Girl Spring on every single album.
New episodes starting March 28th, just in time for Cowboy Carter, up through Dua Lipa's Radical Optimism in May.
So subscribe to every single album on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com. And joining me in the studio, picking up from the events of 1997, it's Charles Holmes! Oh, what's up, man? How are you? Great to see you.
Oh, man, you know, just living this LA lifestyle, you know. I have to be honest, I did not want to burn pod.
Oh, yeah?
I have to bring something up to you.
Dude, go ahead.
When you asked me, like, yo, you want to be on The Watch?
Oh, you thought Andy was going to be here?
No.
Okay.
I knew Andy wasn't going
to
be here.
And shout out to Andy and little admin. I mixed up his spring breaks. He just has so many. So I just didn't know what was happening when and what part of the nation he was going to be in. He'll be back on Thursday.
My issue with this is that, you know, Andy has been on a heater.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
It's been a really good time for Andy.
He's been on the, like, the Blackthorn voice is kind of just like when you're like, oh, LeBron can play forever.
No, you know what it is? It's also for me, it's like his voices were kind of like, that's my bread and my butter.
Yeah,
right?
And he kind of stepped in your corner.
And then
bit.
It was just like, oh, like what if Tiger Woods was also great at math?
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like I didn't know Andy also had that in his bag. I actually did know. Andy's actually like low-key the better impressionist of the two of us, but yes.
But
Andy's been on a heater.
You invited me, and I'm just like, yo, the Watch listeners are going to be like, dog, like, really? You getting Diet Andy? Come on. The pod. But I'm honored.
Never that. So today, Charles and I are going to talk a little bit about, I want to talk to him a little bit about nostalgia, because obviously there's an age gap between me and Charles, but I think we're both feeling some similar things about the nostalgia industry. I'll put it that way. We're also going to talk a little bit about the Gerard Carmichael reality show, which premiered, I think, on Friday on Max and on the HBO network, family of networks. And that's a really interesting conversation to have. I'm not sure where I'm at with that show. And then also we can just hit some other stuff, maybe some Shogun. I could try and sell you on Three Body Problem or whatever. I want to tell you a little story, though, this morning. Back in town after a weekend sojourn. Had to re-up on Greek yogurt and bananas, so I hit up Gelson's, as I'm wont to do. And I was there, and, ringing up, cashier's like, do you need a bag? And I was like, that's all right.
Baller.
I don't need a bag for four bananas and some Greek yogurt. I can do this. But there was a bagger there, and the cashier and the bagger are having a conversation. They just like pick up after I've declined to poison the planet any further. And they were like, yes, yeah, so it's this Godzilla show with Kurt Russell and his son, and it's called Godzilla Minus One. And I was like, I'm sitting there and I got these bananas and I got this Greek yogurt for my protein. And I'm just like, you know what? I'm just going to mind my own fucking business. Why am I going to jump in and be like, actually, that's Kong Legacy you guys were talking about.
First of all, Chris, you have never struck me as someone who would like hop in. There's certain people
I'll
who
hop
like
in,
hop in.
I'll hop in about lots of stuff. I'll hop in about sports all day. I'll be like, oh yeah, I saw that.
But the TV is different.
But I don't hop in. I was just like, this is actually like a great window into the difference between how seriously stuff gets taken, maybe in like our podcasts and stuff like that, where we're like, hold on, I got to remember like the lineage and I got to remember the chronology and the names and the everything, versus like in Gen Pop, people are just trying to have a good time and they don't really care if it's Godzilla or King Kong or if it's Kurt Russell. And I was like, so for me to be like, actually, Godzilla Minus One is a parable about the nuclear age. A lot of people thought it was actually is just as astute about that age as Oppenheimer. And it's like, no. Nobody wants to hear that. You know, like, it was just like very funny to like, do you ever have like when you're out in the world and you're like all week long, you're doing battle with Van and Steve and Jomie on Midnight Boys. You guys are like throwing around like what would Cyclops really do in this situation or whatever. And then you get out. And you're at the barbershop, you're at a bar, you're at a restaurant, you're whatever, and you're hearing like chatter about like the same topic, and you realize that everybody else is free and we're the ones in the jail.
That is my entire life. Like, quite literally went to the barbershop, and my barber goes, yo, so what's your feelings on, you know, Kendrick, Future, Drake, give them to me. And I'm like, do you want like my music critic opinions or my normie opinions? Like, nah, give it to me. Like, da-da-da-da-da. It inspired like an hour-long argument. And I was just like, this isn't worth it, bro.
Right.
This is like similarly, like women will be like, oh, what's your podcast about? Let me look it up. And I'm just like, if you look up my podcast or listen to 30 seconds of it, I will never talk to you ever.
Right.
And they're like, why? And I'm just like, you don't need me to hear me yelling at three grown men about how they didn't adapt Cyclops' Madeline Pryor story correctly. Like, no, dog, no.
So do you feel like it's like the knowledge winds up like, are you getting to the point? Because this is the reason why I wanted to talk to you this week, is you guys were talking about X-Men 97, which is this animated series on Disney Plus that's been airing. I completely missed the original animated series. Like, I think I knew it existed, but I had no relationship.
How old were you in 97?
I was hanging out in Boston age. Like, I was in college. Like, so I was 20 in 97, I think.
So yeah. You weren't like Van. You weren't crushing X-Men tape.
Not then. No. I mean, and also like to like, I think you guys talked about this a little bit about some of the series and like even some of like, what was the one that was the movie kind of that came on? It would only come on at like 3 a.m.
Oh,
what,
yeah. Van was talking about, because like I've seen that one. It was like, I want to say it
like
might have been Kitty
Show or Kitty Pryde.
Yeah.
Pryde.
It was like, and it was this weird type of like show that was supposed to be a show but never became one. So it just ended up as a long movie.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, we start getting more and more into like the way wagon trains worked. But back then in 97, I don't think we had cable at the house I was living at. If we did, it was only to watch sports. And then like in the home media rotation was not some bootleg copy of the X-Men animated series. So, but you have to understand, it's not like I had it at my fingertips. Had I had Disney Plus in 1997, maybe I would have watched the animated show. I doubt it, but yeah, I was not watching it then. And
so this is like a fun, like that is a foundational text to me. Also because like all my uncles had grown up on like the Chris Claremont stuff, Star Trek, everything. So when the TV show came out, it was the one time where they're just like, oh, y'all watching that nerdy Disney shit? Let me put y'all on. And then it would be like X-Men. And that was the first time I'm like, this motherfucker got knives coming out of his hands. Oh shit, let's go to the comic book store.
See, my relationship to comics is different. Like, I feel like I'm the dude who got to try heroin once with comics. And I like really, really had like an intense couple of summers with it but I was able to then leave it like behind and like move on, not move on like it's better for you to move on, but like I was able to like then go into other things while still retaining some baseline of knowledge. And like I know now, like Andy has such like a complete grasp of like X-Men narrative, and I'll be like, what did Cable do again? Didn't he go back in time, but he had a disease, but he was trying to kill somebody who had the disease?
Virus.
Yeah.
But so, here's the thing, Chris, I feel like I had a similar trajectory to you, you know, where it was just like, it was comic books. I was coming to school in middle school with the comic book t-shirts, whatever. And then it was like the mixtape era I was like, oh shit, Lil Wayne is popping. Oh, Jay-Z, like, da-da-da-da, Connie's. And I'm like, overnight, I was just like, dog, I'm getting no shoddies with the comic books.
Yeah.
So I kind of like tucked that in.
And did you get a lot of shoddies with the mixtapes?
A few. I wasn't cleaning up, but they were just like, hey, if he's going to talk my ear off about
Dat Piff message boards, you guys were really connecting.
I mean, hey, all I will say is that like the shot was just like, you know what? I would much rather hear him talk about like why I can't feel my face is on the great songs versus like what is Cable doing in the fucking future. But
Nathan Summers' inheritance and what that really is about. Yeah.
Unfortunately, with The Ringer, when I came over here, they pulled me back in. For years, I was just like, oh, shit, I get to be the guy at the bar who's like, that music y'all like, kind of whack. And now I'm just like, oh, random people come into me at a party and they're just like, everything you just said about X-Men 97 is fucking bullshit and I hate you. And I'm just like, dog, you are blowing up my fucking spot. Now. Shut up.
It's like, X-Men 97? What's that? Okay, so the reason why I'm bringing all this up is that you guys were sort of, if you listen to Midnight Boys, like they'll have like these, it's basically like this roundtable discussion between Charles and Van, and then it's Jomie and Steve weighing in as well, and they will very vociferously argue their feelings about whatever given property they're talking about that week. Obviously, X-Men 97 came up, and it was almost like when you're watching like a Paul Thomas Anderson movie and the title doesn't get shown until 21 minutes in. I was like, Charles hasn't talked yet. Because Jomie and Steven Van were like, this is it. This is the original Coke recipe. Mm-hmm. This is what we do this for. This is why we get up every day. This is why we grind the tape. It's because of feelings like this. And Van was really actually talking about like, this is about as close to in my brain when I bring comics to life in my brain and think about it. You know, and if you daydream a storyline from a comic book, that this is it for him.
Yeah.
And it goes and goes and goes. And then Charles is just like, just didn't hit for me. You know, and I could hear the regret in your voice because you sincerely did seem happy that those guys were happy.
Oh, that's why, like, usually, you know, I'm in there immediately, like, arguing. And it's like, X-Men, I think, holds a special place not only in my heart, but if you're of a certain generation, especially if you're Black, like, I don't even, like, go to the comic book store anymore, but I will still pop in with the X-Men just because I care about them so much.
Yes.
And I knew that that is a lot of what the conversation was going to be. So usually I'm so excited to fucking step on their shit and just be like, this is terrible. And I actually, in the moment, was like, I feel like an asshole having to like pop the balloon.
Well, and especially over this particular franchise, right? Because it doesn't give you any joy to be let down by something that I think for a lot, I think if all of us share one thing in The Watch, like in House of R, like I definitely feel like even Fantasy recognizes that like X-Men is the one.
Yes.
Like X-Men is the thing that probably was the gateway drug. Maybe Spider-Man was because, like, you look at it and you're like, that's a teenager too. It's just like me or whatever. But, like, X-Men is the one where you're like, this feels very adult. This feels very, like, emotionally fucked up. But also the story is insane. And as you keep reading the comics, you're like, how am I watching this thing about, like, clone Jean, you know, coming back from Mr. Sinister and all this stuff that's, like, pretty complicated for a young reader and then pretty engaging as you get older and return to them. Like, I'm not going to... I do go back and read some X-Men stuff and I'm like, this is pretty out there. Like, this is pretty awesome the way that they're introducing these pretty adult and or transgressive ideas through this superhero team-up.
I mean, I always envision the X-Men. The best X-Men writers, like, this is going to sound like a joke. It's not. That's where they get their freak shit off. Like, if you go back and you read, like, the Claremont comics, you're like, dog, there's BDSM in this shit.
Yes.
There's, it's like people are cheating, people are falling in and out of love, there's love triangles in it. And I think the reason X-Men resonates so much is I could be like a black person walking into a club and I might meet a queer person or someone who's like Latino or whatever. And if you just start talking about X-Men, 9 times out of 10, they're like, oh shit, let me tell you about my favorite X-Men maggot from the night. And I'm like, immediately you're friends, whether you agree or not. And I think the thing that kind of, and you can help me through this because I'm aging now.
Yeah.
I'm officially washed. When I go out, the 20-year-olds are like, you're fucking washed, right, bro. Is that I don't know who X-Men 97 is for, or I know who it's for in terms of like, this is a show that is supposed to be for the 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old in me at 31. And that is just not an interesting artistic proposition to me anymore because I feel like we are coming out of 15 years where I was like, oh shit, it's happening. We're finally able to pull off all the stuff. It's all going to be great. Right. It's all going to be good. And we're now kind of getting to a point where X-Men 97, it's like, oh, you guys are quite literally verbatim just picking up where this left off. The animation doesn't look that great. The storylines, the way they talk is exactly like the 90s show. And we talked about it on the Midnight Boys. I'm like, 90s cartoons are very much like, all right, we're restating the problem every 5 minutes because dumb kids can't pay attention. And they're still doing that. And I'm like, dog, I can't get jiggy with this shit.
Yeah.
I'm watching show. I can't get jiggy with this shit at 31. I'm sorry.
So one of the most pernicious and interesting things that's happened with nostalgia is obviously the creation of the nostalgia industry. And to scale nostalgia, they've basically compressed the time that something becomes an object of nostalgia for people. Yeah. So, I mean, we're at the Ringer in Grantland, like we were not above, like, we started noticing that people would get really into the 5-year anniversary of something, the 10-year anniversary of something, because you widen the aperture of people who can participate in the celebration and the memory, the memory exercise of being like, oh yeah, that's when Interpol's record came out. Yeah. You know what I mean? And we're, you know, we really, like, I think probably because the way that the internet just churns through experience so much faster than the world before the internet, like, it already feels like Cowboy Carter's been out for like 6 weeks, right?
Yes.
Like, and it's like the shit leaked, came out, had a masterpiece cycle, a blowback cycle, and now there's like an explainer cycle, and it already feels like, I feel like that record came out like Valentine's Day or something.
I feel like there are so many quite literal tangents of the Cowboy Carter, because it's like, the cycle started even before that because all the Diddy stuff started happening.
It happened to start with the Super Bowl, right?
Yeah, and then we get the Super Bowl, and then once the Diddy stuff started happening, Jay gets in the news because everybody's like, let's, I don't know why they're attacking each other, like, let's get Jay out of the cut too. And then it was just like Cowboy Carter comes out and they're just like, all right, it's a country album. And then it's like, there's a Jolene conversation. Uh-huh. There is a what is and isn't country conversation. There's like, can we even critique Beyonce conversation? And I'm like, this record feels like it's been out for a year already.
Right.
And I don't even want to talk about it. And to your point, nostalgia, because I was of the age when I'm reading Grantland or reading a bunch of websites where I'm like, oh, this is so dope. 5-year anniversaries, 10-year anniversaries, Pitchfork goes crazy. Shout out Jeff Weiss. I was reading his Mad Villainy piece, all that shit. I was like, I was growing up on that stuff. And you probably feel it, us working at The Ringer, where it's like, nostalgia almost doesn't do what it used to do anymore because we're burnt out on it. So
that's exactly where, the thing that's amazing about X-Men 97. So like 2 weeks ago, I think like one bored night, I like went back and watched a couple of episodes of the original series on Disney Plus, where it has all the seasons right there. Yeah. Now X-Men 97 is there. 3 episodes have come out, I think, maybe 4.
Yeah, 3.
And it sounds like this will be a running thing for Disney and for Marvel. It sounds like they've already, the writer has left the show, but like they've already got like 2 or 3 seasons kind of like charted out. But what you're saying is exactly right. To give it to people, if they're still listening, a non-superhero context, there's been in the news that they're looking to reboot The Office. But The Office reboot in the X-Men 97 fashion would, I mean, frankly, literally, like, just be, like, the next day, Jim and Pam come back to The Office, and all the characters are back at the office and Michael has come back to the office. And it is not recognized as a, I mean, I guess in the X-Men 97 thing, it's like Charles Xavier is quote unquote dead, but it's treated as a major event, but it's not treated as like a timeline changing event. It's yes. like, we're just going along. It would just be like, if you were like, you know what? I love The Office. I've watched The Office 5 or 6 times all the way through. I wish there was more Office. And they were like, yeah, rather than try and roll the dice and come up with like a new take on The Office, we're just going to make more Office. And that is literally what X-Men 97 is. Now, it has much different cultural context, but do you think that's like a fair analogy?
That is such a fair analogy. And it was one where I was just like, oh, I'm the one on the outside of this party, because for a lot of people, that is exactly actually what they want.
Right.
They wanted that, like, do not change this at all. Just serve it up to me exactly how it was in the 90s. But when I was watching it was funny. We were arguing. I was like, I don't know if you could, like, give this to, like, Andy's daughters and they'd be like, cool.
Well, they wouldn't have the context clues, right?
Yeah.
Because unless they had binged the first one. Because when you watch the first one, and I'm going to come into this by being like, I kind of liked it in the sense of 97, in the sense of like the story and the plot points, at least. And even the characterizations to some extent were pretty close to what's in my head when I read the comics.
Yeah.
The action is not. The action is I think, quite poor, to quote Sean Fantasy. And it's like, it is just like, it is like a constant reverse dopamine hit where you think you're supposed to get to a set piece action scene and your adrenaline's supposed to go up because it's exciting. And instead you're like, oh, these are the limitations of the animation that they're doing. And I already have like kind of an animation block anyway. So I find myself really zoning out, half like almost want to channel surf while people are fighting. Even though the scenarios, like in the first episode, the X-Men come across a Sentinel factory. And for people who don't know, Sentinels are kind of like the X-Men, like red shirt. Like it's basically like the robotic villains that attack X-Men.
The jobbers, the ones that they just got to dispatch.
But it is a pretty awesome depiction of what Sentinels look like to, like, in terms of scale to the X-Men. Now,
yeah.
Like they are able to just punch out these giant robots and it's pretty stupid. But the actual moment where Trask is like, beep, and wakes all the Sentinels up, I was like, yo, this is kind of like, this is what happens in the comic books. Like,
yes.
This is literally like a comic book moment come to life. And there are a few moments sprinkled out throughout the episodes where I was like, it's kind of scratching the old thing. But the idea of taking 97 era or 96 era animation and 96 era writing, and I think you pointed this out where it's like almost all of the dialogue is characters restating where they are in the story and what has just happened and what might happen.
Or what even their powers are. Sometimes they're like, I'm a rogue and you can't touch me. And I was like, all right.
Right. And it is the most like, it was like when they first were like, well, we have to give voices to these characters. And they were like, well, Rogue is this like sassy Southern woman and Gambit is a Cajun gambler. You know, like all these ideas about these people, like they have not iterated one bit.
No.
In almost 30 years, right? Like whatever it's been. So it's pretty crazy to watch this and be like, it is almost like methadone. Like to go back to my heroin joke, it's like getting the, like, you know, it's the diluted treatment for what you are actually addicted to. But at the same time, like there is something in there that it's almost like, I'm like, I admire Disney's gall for doing it.
But this seems like kind of what they're just planning on doing moving forward,
right?
Even with like Fantastic Four, where it's like, because we've never gotten a good adaptation of Fantastic Four, they're just like, well, how do we get them? They're like, dog, nostalgia. We're going back to when,
right,
Jack and Stan made this shit.
Right.
We're going to give you the Beatles song. We're going to give you this feeling. And it's like, that's cool. In the same way that like Deadpool 3 is like holding all of superhero cinema on its shoulders. How? Yo, we're bringing Hugh Jackman back. We're bringing Elektra back. We're just going full tilt.
Are they bringing Elektra back in Deadpool?
I mean, that's the rumors.
Like Jennifer Garner Capital One,
yes,
Venture card? Oh, wow.
And that's where we're at with nostalgia, where I'm like, yo, like I said, I'm a 31-year-old man. It's, you can't keep hitting that tap until I'm a little, not only burnt out, sometimes I'm like, this is just, it makes me feel weird now. It makes me feel kind of gross. And it's like, this year for TV and movies, to me, has been so great because they've run out. And it's like, oh, we would have never talked about Shogun on Midnight Boys
right.
in another year. And now it's like, damn, we got Invincible X-Men 97. Let's sneak Shogun in here. Yeah. We can do that. And I'm like, that's why it's not working for me.
Well, okay. So I think that that's a really interesting place to jump off of, though, because there are times when you're into something, when you're a fan of something, where you kind of will have this attitude where it's like, I really just want more of this, right? Like, I think when you're younger, the cool thing about being younger is that, like, you're voracious. And yeah. if you're really into culture, I remember those mixtape days too. And it was just like, it literally felt like every Wednesday someone pushed the medium forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would get a Wayne tape or you would get like just a Gangster Grills and find out about three dudes you'd never heard of before. These are like mixtape series from like the aughts. And you would be like, I feel rap expanding right before my ears and before my eyes. Like I can feel the guys tweak what the fuck this art form is like in an almost real time way. And it was such a thrill to be a part of that, like even as a fan. And then to feel like both as consumers, but also as creators, people have been like, let's hit stop. let's hit stop. Let's not take any chances by fucking up, you know, like let's not take any chances by doing another Thanos snap, you know, or anything that might upset people or change the way people relate to this stuff or feel about it. And we'll draw a line. And what we'll do now is color in the pictures we've already drawn, you know? So we'll go back and while these people are all ambulatory and Hugh Jackman can still gain weight, muscle mass to do this, we're going to go back and do that. We're going to go back and instead of doing a new X-Men thing where we'll have to answer all these questions about like, well, what does this mean for the live action films that are supposed to be coming? And what does this mean for the MCU timeline and the secret timeline and all this stuff? What if we just gave people literally the plunger of what they were watching when they were children? Because that's what they're watching anyway, what they were watching when they were children.
But yeah, but it's also, it's this thing where it's like, all these companies are speaking to the vocal minority, like in Star Wars, where it was just like, after the fucking Last Jedi hits, it's just like the Clone Wars audience, the Filoni audience, that one who was tapped in, they're like, we watch everything. Star Wars is like, all right, you guys are going to lead this. And now it's happening with the MCU, where it's like, oh, we're no longer a product for everyone. This isn't something like, oh, yo, there's a new Iron Man, boys, like we're rolling out. Yeah. It's like, we're talking to the people who are going to get excited that Jennifer Garner Electra is coming back.
Right.
And I'm just like, that is just a smaller segment, which is like fine, but it's like, as the pie gets smaller, I'm like, why should I be interested in this anymore? And that's a thing that like on the Midnight Boys, we have conversations about like, yo, what is fandom anymore? Is Shogun? Is Monkey Man? Is all of these things? Because it feels like even with Barbie and Barbenheimer last year, I was like, we have to talk about this stuff in a way that like when we first started the show, not that long ago with like Falcon and the Winter Soldier, it was like, yo, we got WandaVision, we got Falcon, we got Moon Knight, we got all this stuff. There's no time for anything else. And now I'm like,
this is the quietest it's been.
And I feel rejuvenated.
Well, maybe because everybody's clearing out for Deadpool, like you said, and also because a couple of these franchises are in soft reset mode. So the post-Downey era of Marvel has had like these missteps. So they're like probably like, okay, how do we basically like clear our books to start again with Fantastic Four and X-Men whenever we decide to do that? That's like basically the chip that they have to play. But the same can be said for Star Wars. For as excited as I am for Acolyte and especially Andor season 2, those are both within the context of Star Wars historical fiction, right? Like they're just going to be playing with. I mean, I guess like nobody's really like seen a ton of stuff that during the period that Acolyte is set, unless like there's video games or something like that. But like, there's not a lot of like common knowledge about like what the prequels era of Star Wars was like. And that's a pretty cool window to look through. And Andor is Andor. It's almost barely Star Wars in some ways, or transcends Star Wars to me. But they still are like, I don't know what we're going to do about whether this, does the calendar ever flip forward?
I mean, when they were like, oh, we're doing a Mandalorian movie, I was like, oh, this is y'all.
Yeah.
Kind of like, all right, this gives us at least 2-3 more years to figure out what is going to happen. Because like, even with, they're like, oh, we're bring Daisy Ridley back. I'm like, excuse me, what? It's like, when we're talking about nostalgia, I'm like, is there even enough, has enough time passed for there to be like the Force Awakens nostalgia?
Yeah, isn't Daisy Ridley's a little young to become Carrie Fisher in the sequels? You know what I mean? Like, where she's presumably going to be the connective tissue that goes from the sequels to whatever these next set of movie or movies are going to be. It's a bit odd.
And that is why it's like, when people probably hear like my exhaustion on the Midnight Boys, I still have so much love for all this stuff, but it is like, oh, the corporate machinations of this. Even we were talking, I think mixtapes are a really, really good kind of like metaphor, because if you think about it, Wayne was super interesting when he's dropping Dedication, Trouts, whatever. It's like, oh, I'm on Dat Piff. I'm on live mixtapes. Mm-hmm. I'm on all this shit. And I remember when Carter 3 dropped, it was a moment, but I was like, oh, it's over. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt it. I was just like, oh, he's in industry now. And then Drake came, and then Nicki came. And I'm like, it's just a different proposition.
Yeah.
When the clips, you know, when the clips are dropping mixtapes, you're just like, yo, Hell Hath No Fury, never coming, all this shit. It's a different proposition when Pusha T signs to Good Music, and all of a sudden,
it's like every 18 months to 2 years, he puts out an album that's really good. It just doesn't have the, like, breathless buzz.
Yes.
And the, so for people who don't know what we're talking about, like, clips, who, you know, you would know from Grindin', but have made, like, obviously dozens of classics and incredible albums since then. Clips have had a point where they were, like, in major label purgatory, and they were supposed to be releasing the long-awaited follow-up to Lord Willin, and it had been done and all this stuff, and they were in this contract label hell and started putting out mixtapes called We Got It For Cheap, Volume 1 and 2, that were basically like, we can't really get our shit out there any other way, so what we're going to do is rap over basically the best 12 beats that are out right now, that were the ones that we're obsessed with. And those two mixtapes are absolute stone cold classics. And I put Volume 2 up against like any rap record.
But that was Cliff. That was 50. That was,
yeah,
Wayne.
That was,
it was Gucci. It's Jeezy. And it's like, you saw, like, it was a little early for me. So I come in around the tail end and I'm like,
it's really hard to think of what a comic book analogy to We Got It For Cheap Volume 2 would be.
But it's like, I mean, I'm young
enough. I
guess
that would be Deadpool. I don't even know. Like, I mean, I guess it would be like, what if I took this character that people don't really know about and like just imbued him with my own personality? But like, that's maybe giving Ryan Reynolds too much credit.
It's just, it is, we're at the point where I'm just like, oh, the mixtapes are over now. Everybody's dropping major label albums. Mm-hmm. And they're like, all right, I gotta have one for the shoddies. I gotta have one for the club.
Yeah,
I have to have this.
The formulaic nature of it.
Because
yeah.
I'll ask you, do you even think in 2024, I don't know who is the Robert Downey Jr. equivalent, but would Kevin Feige even take a chance at this point on like restarting or helping an actor who had that much baggage? I'm like, not really.
I don't think I rightly or wrongly, like without any, getting into that, like I don't really know if the fans would let it happen, right? Because like the way in which Downey was perceived during his like time in the wilderness, like was a lot more like bad boy rebel fuck up than was this problematic, or like, did anybody get hurt in the process of like this dude having, you know, his drug sojourn?
Yeah.
And when you think about like some of the people out there who would be prospects for such a rehabilitation by Kevin Feige, it's like highly unlikely that Shia LaBeouf would be fucking Reed Richards.
And here's the thing, I'm not saying that he should do that, but it's just like, even taking a chance on like,
it's so different. Yeah.
On an actor who you're just like, when Downey was announced, I was like, Robert Downey Jr., what the fuck?
But, yeah.
Like,
yes.
But it's like, I don't feel that way about any of their announcements anymore. When the Fantastic Four announcements came out, I was like, okay, sure. Like, it wasn't even anything to get mad or excited about. I'm like, this is very good brand management.
Well, it was so strange because Andy and I would joke about Fantastic Four casting rumors because Andy gets most of his culture news through his Facebook feed. And so he just gets like comicsbook.net recommended post on like who would be like in the cast. And he would send them to me as screenshots. And it was really funny because like when they actually did announce that cast, it was like more or less like chalk. It was like, yeah, Pedro Pascal instead of Krasinski or whoever, like Adam Driver. But for the most part, like that's Vanessa Kirby had been attached to that role for a really long time. Yeah. And like Joseph Quinn has been getting like a lot of really big roles. And it was awesome that Eben got the thing. But like, it's like what we thought. And then you're like, oh, wait, they haven't even written or shot a frame of this movie. And in my mind, we've been talking about, and this has been around for like the better part of 18 months, if not 2 years.
And I mean, like, even Eben getting the thing, you're just like, it used to be like, oh, they plucked Chris Pratt out of Parks and Rec. And he's
well, the
be
crazy thing would have been to give Eben Reed.
Yes. But now it's just like, you're worried because you see all these other actors departing, like Thunderbolts and like all this other shit. And now it's flipped where you're just like, oh, this actor is in an MCU movie. They're going to be a star. Now you're like, I hope this doesn't fuck up their career. Like, that's where we're at. And I think that's even where I'm at emotionally, just with superheroes in general, with even the James Gunn Superman stuff, where I'm like, it feels like he's going to go back to that nostalgic Superman feeling.
Right.
Look at how transformative comic books are. A man could fly, did it all this stuff. And I'm just so jaded off all of it.
Well, and he's probably making a bet that culture is ready to pivot towards sincerity.
Are we not there already?
Well, that's actually not a bad bridge into Gerard. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
but I want to just say, like, everything that I get the vibe from the way that James Gunn talks about Superman is going to be probably something that I really admire the bones of. And I'm like, it's going to probably be like mechanically a really well-told story. And I'm excited to see what he does with it. I don't really have like a much of an affinity for Superman, but I'm interested. But it's interesting that he's like, yeah, like this character symbolizes something very important and sacred. And those things are doing the right thing, selflessness, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, I wonder if this is going to hit. Like, I'm sure it'll do really well.
No, it's probably like, the right gamble. But even like those Guardians movies, I'm like, I think the thing about the Guardians movies as they continued that James Gunn is one of the most talented directors to touch those MCU movies. But as the sincerity increased across,
it became more about like friendship and animal rights.
And like Muppet Baby shit. Yeah. No, like it's like, I like those movies. But there was a level where I'm just like, ugh, I'm okay. Like there was the first Guardians. I liked it so much. I was like, there was a little acid on that shit.
Yeah.
There was a little like, he still had that very much like rebel thing about his filmmaking where it's like, all right, it's a talking raccoon, but we're going to make
it. Well, it was also just like, nobody thinks this is going to work.
Yes.
Right? Like no one's ever heard of these people. I remember that was like, when we were podcasting about that back then, it was like, this is the biggest heat check. They're just like literally like playing roulette with Marvel titles.
Yes.
And just being like, what about these motherfuckers? What about this raccoon? And they would just, they can be like, we'll get a billion out of anything right now. Like we can dial up a box office monster out of any combination of words if it has the Marvel flip page in the beginning.
But here's the thing. If I see, you know, Clark Kent crying over dead crypto, I'm going to be like, yo, come on, bro. I'm done. I'm done with this. Let's like, because I think it's happening in pop music. I think it's happening in movies where it's like the therapy speak, sincerity, like there's so much division in the world, y'all. Let us believe in humanity again by selling you these big ass IP characters. And I'm just like, all right, miss me.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
All right, let's talk about Gerard.
You always bring me on here to talk about Gerard. I'm so honored.
I'm deeply fascinated with this person, even if I don't know if I love watching television about his personal life. And it's really just down to the fact that at this point, I feel like Gerard Carmichael's project, and you know, obviously if you watch Rathaniel, which was the Emmy Award-winning stand-up, quote-unquote, special that he did, directed by Bo Burnham, that one was, right? Yep. You know that he has been going through a time of great personal upheaval and that his comedy, so to speak, is really now become more of a confessional but also performance of his self on stage where he directly communicates with the audience about like literally whatever's been happening with him up to that hour. Like, and in the Gerard Carmichael reality show, like he's honestly like looking at text messages and waiting for responses from a very significant rapper to and informing the audience of like a minute by minute of his emotional state in his love life. So he's got priors with Rathaniel. He's obviously very interested in the public consumption of his incredibly private moments, of which they're like his project seems to be like there are no private moments, right?
Yep.
Like, and not only not private, like I'm always on my phone and I'm always streaming or documenting it. It's I have like a professional camera crew living with me in a hotel in West Hollywood to film my Grindr dates, but also film like the state of my relationship with my mother, which I narrate to two of my like childhood friends, and his kind of like wandering through the world as he tries to figure out who he is and who will love him and who he's going to love. And all these things are really interesting. Did you find the show interesting?
I found the swing interesting. I don't know if I like this first episode. And I laughed a lot. But before I even get into my thoughts, I wanted to pick your brain a little bit.
Okay.
Because I realized that the thing about this show that I was bumping up against is I'm like, what I enjoyed about Curb Your Enthusiasm when I was a teenager growing up is like, I was probably part of the last generation that became a Seinfeld fan, not because I sought it out, but because I was at my grandparents' house. And it's like, Seinfeld's the only thing fucking on, and there's a lot of it, just crushing tape. And then it's like, you learn about Larry David and you get HBO and you're like, I'm just going to watch Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I'm still so young, so I'm learning about the lore, I'm reading about the lore, but I have a certain distance from all of the players, which helps me enjoy it, where this Carmichael reality show is very
like
much...
Like, you're not watching Curb and you're like, I know all about Super Dave playing Funkhauser or whatever. Like,
yeah,
you know,
I learn
like,
about a lot of that stuff later.
Like, you learn about Richard Lewis after the fact, right? Okay.
Where it's, with this show, I'm like, oh, this is Curb? But it's like, these are your, like, these are people that I was writing about, podcasting about, writing reviews about. I know way too much about Tyler, the creator.
Yes.
We're almost this, I think we're the same age, where it's like, you make an entire first episode about Tyler, the creator, curving you is just some shit that I'm just like, no.
So that's obviously going to be the big headline takeaway from this episode.
But I want to ask you really quick, is it weird for you watching this? Because these aren't your contemporaries in the same way with Curb, you're way closer to Larry David and Seinfeld and all of that stuff than I am.
So you look at me and you think that's a guy who's way closer to Larry David's age than Tyler, the creator's age?
I think so. If we're being real. So you're just like, you're watching this. You're
holy
like,
shit, that is so sobering. But yeah. Okay.
But you like your connection with Curb. Like, did you ever sometimes
I'm 12 years older than Gerard. And I am more than 12 years younger than Larry David, I think.
Yes, but culturally speaking.
Okay.
Who do you think you're closer to?
Larry David. I think. Yeah.
And that makes the equation different. For you watching the show, for me watching Carmichael, I'm like, I'm about to drop some shit off, like the shit that's happening in this, where you're just like, yeah, I wasn't outside like that. Like, I didn't even understand that that's what's happening. And I'm like, that's what makes it hard for me.
Right. I think, so this episode is basically like an introduction to the concept of the show, which is that Gerard feels more comfortable telling the truth to the camera than he does, like, basically in private, right? So he is going to document his private life as if it was a TV show, hence the Gerard Carmichael reality show, and explore like the quote unquote, I don't know, like objective truth of any moment, which several people come through the episode, both like in passing, like in like Grindr dates, and then also as like clearly like close people in his life. I mentioned the childhood friends, an anonymous character who refuses to be seen is played pretty obviously by Bo Burnham.
Yes.
Bo Burnham, 6'5". Didn't know that.
That's why I was just like, take off the mask, dude. I don't like, I know you're Bo Burnham, bro. Like, come on.
And I, you know, with him, it's like, and I also know Bo Burnham just from hearing him talk about like his feelings about social media and the way that content is created and consumed now, that I assume both that he does not want to be a part of this, but also desperately wants to be a part of this to comment on what the this of this is.
Yes.
But yes, like obviously it would have just been hilarious if Bo Burnham was at the door when he answers it. So it essentially documents this first episode, and I believe it's 6 or 7 episodes. I can't remember how long it is, but
I read maybe 8.
Okay. So it's essentially like Gerard Carmichael's in LA for the Emmys after doing like a bunch of promo for Rathaniel, and then comes back to Los Angeles for the Emmys. He's doing some stand-up gigs here and there. And the main narrative is that he has, in the weeks prior, declared his feelings of romantic interest in Tyler, the Creator, who is also his like really, really, really close friend.
Yes.
And has basically only heard back from Tyler a real like snappy comeback 6-second voice message that's like, you're a bitch, if I remember correctly.
The most Tyler, the Creator response.
And then hasn't really heard from him otherwise. And like has tried to get him to go to the Emmys with him. And I think Tyler's like, I'm busy that night or something. And okay, I guess I'll ask you, did you think that how much of this relationship that we're seeing on screen is quote unquote for cameras? Because I think it's very purposeful that Carmichael named this show reality show. You know, like,
yes,
it's not the Gerard Carmichael show. It's not My Life and My Love with Gerard Carmichael. It's the reality show, which, you know, if you watch enough reality television, there are really easy and clear ways that they assemble a narrative out of however many hours of footage they get.
Yeah.
And I was curious whether or not you thought that the Tyler thing was like a really raw, incredible moment of real life that was being captured, or something that was being performed by two people who are hyper-conscious of how their fan base thinks about them.
So the reason why I was like, what the show is kind of going out of its way to make it seem like it's a raw and emotional moment. But probably because I have music critic brain, probably because I was like, when Tyler drops Flower Boy, which is the first album that he's starting to hint about his sexual journey, mm-hmm. about, you know, potentially just not being a straight rapper. He's never confirmed it, but he's using different pronouns, whatever. Carmichael was a part of that project. They have this video, everything. I already know that. So I'm like, they've been friends for a while.
Yeah.
That project comes out forever ago. You have Igor, you have Rathaniel, you have everything. So I'm like, the possibility that they filmed this, that this is when he's saying, I had feelings for you, like just timeline-wise for me, I'm just like, because when this is supposed to be when he wins his Emmy for Rathaniel. So I'm starting to do the math.
That's 22, right?
Yeah. So I'm just like, I don't know if this like lines up or whatever. And then it was like, as they start talking,
you're like, is this the sacred timeline?
Yeah. I was like, the punchlines are almost too good at certain points. Like when the guy, like they're having this big moment and Tyler's essentially like doing the thing. He's like, you're like a brother to me. And then the food comes in.
It's amazing.
It's the funniest thing, but I'm like, that's actually too funny. Like, this is the perfect time for the food to arrive. And then at one point, like, I think Gerard goes to Tyler. He's like, so what are you seeking? And Tyler goes, in life or on this plate? I'm like, that's just too good of a punchline.
Yeah.
Like, and it's, and I am sure that that conversation did happen. I'm sure that, like, all of this did, but as someone who's like worked at music magazines, I know how controlling Tyler, the Creator is, how selective he is. Like, he's only doing things that he wants to do, that he believes in artistically. And I'm just like, would Tyler, the Creator agree to just be on any reality show? Or would he agree to be on the trollish reality show that's like, hey, remember that time I revealed that I had deep feelings for you, Tyler? We're going to recreate that for this fake reality show. Come through.
Like Nathan Fielder style, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I'm like, that's the project that Tyler would be like, absolutely. The sincere project of like, hey, I'm trying to work through what it means to be a queer man and this and that, da da da. Tyler's like, fuck all that shit.
Yeah.
The minute it's just like, oh, I get to embarrass you on screen. Tyler, Creator gets to curve Gerard and like fart. Hell yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
It felt like, I don't know if you watch Adult Swim's Loiter Squad. I'm like, this is some Loiter Squad-ass Odd Future humor baked into, like you said, a Nathan Fielder-esque type box.
I was thinking a lot during that scene, which is really incredible to watch. So Tyler comes in and like, Tyler, I gotta say, if he's quote unquote acting or not, like it's a great performance because he's
almost better than Gerard, like naturalistically.
Well, yeah, and there is almost something like really interesting where you could definitely see what Gerard sees in Tyler, and you can see why Tyler kind of holds back a little bit, and because of what he's holding back, that makes it all the more attractive to Gerard, right? Yep. But there's something just like you said, so perfectly timed about like even like the way he just destroys like the food that he gets. Then like Gerard offers him some of his food and he's like, I don't want anything to do with anything that's happening in that bowl, which of course is also like a metaphorical rejection of Gerard anyway. And, but I did think that there was like a real like moment of magic when Gerard's like, you still haven't answered me. Like we're talking about it, but like, even in talking about it, you still haven't been like, I don't like you that way, or I, you know, like, I don't know how to feel about that. He's just like, and Tyler is just like, I don't know what you want me to say. Like, first of all, like, and then that's when he goes into like, you're like my brother. And like, I wouldn't ever like jeopardize that. And I'm going to call you. And then like, as he's leaving, he's like, I'm going to call you next week. And I believe him. But while I was watching that scene, it was reminding me of like early Real World seasons, you know, where that was a generation of people that did not know what it was like to be on camera and did not know what it was going to be like when they were broadcast out to the world. And there is a real lack of self-consciousness, both in terms of like their like personality being projected, like how they're behaving themselves, but also how they like look. Like they're just like, hey, it's the morning, I didn't put my makeup on yet, you know what I mean? Like this is like how I'm chilling out like at this house. And over the years, if you watch Real World, but if you watch really any long-running reality show or any reality show that's post a certain period, people are going on those reality shows knowing full well what they're signing up for. In fact, they're more thinking about what the benefits are going to be of going on those reality shows after the fact. Like, yeah. I even think Top Chef is like that sometimes, where it's like, winning Top Chef seems real fucking hard, a little bit random, and I don't even know if it's that lucrative, but what happens to your career if you've won Top Chef is like, you're kind of like made. And
I can get a little social media agent. I can get
your restaurants will always have like the kind of like, when I go to cities that I've never been to before and I hear about like, oh, so-and-so from Top Chef has a restaurant here, I'm like, I'll go check that out.
I mean, like, isn't that what we do for a living, even podcasting? It's like, we were both writers before this. And it was like, when I was a writer, I had like people who enjoyed my writing, but it wasn't like, hey, yo, Charles, like, let's talk. Well, your podcast, it's like, oh, this is a different thing where it's just like, oh, now people like want to talk to me about podcasting in a way. It's like, if I wrote the same thing down and just published it, you're like, I don't give a fuck about that. And I think the genius of this is like, Gerard knows Tyler, and it's like Odd Future for like the people who don't know. It's like Odd Future comes out at a time when it's like, they are very in your face. They have very misogynistic, homophobic lyrics. But the grand irony is like the biggest artists that come out of that collective all end up being
They're basically edgelords.
Like, edgelords. Yeah. Like they were doing like a very like post Eminem, you know, type thing.
Everybody of our generation is supposed to be sensitive and like, you know, completely like speaking the language of like acceptance, and we're going to make jokes about it.
And it's like with Frank Ocean was very much like, oh, like, not only am I gay, but a lot of my music is going to be interrogating this. And you had, you know, artists like Sid, their DJ, who had turned into the internet, all this stuff. But with Tyler, I was in rooms before where, like, people were just like, oh, Tyler, well, he, you know, he's gay or he's bisexual and we should do a certain thing. And I'm like, no. Tyler's actually never said any of that.
Yeah.
He's the most withholding. And that's what, like, is the genius of that scene, where it's like, even when Tyler is making music about like his love for a woman or his love potentially for a man or this or that, there's a level of remove where he's never going to give you the thing you want. He's never going to give you the New Yorker profile that's like, here's who I am, someone's following me, blah, blah, blah. There's always that level of, ha, 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 fuck you, prankster shit.
Yeah,
about
right.
Him. Which,
when he walks into the hotel room, he's like, I've invited orgies that had less people than this, or like I've had orgies that had less people than like the size of the camera crew there. I guess my point about the real world stuff was that even if it's a sincere moment, I feel like Tyler and Gerard know how to be on camera.
Yes.
And I think that there is still like a part of me that expects people to be like, what the fuck is going on? Why are all these cameras here? And I maybe it's just a time in the world where that is no longer a phenomenon. It's just to have cameras constantly pointed at you. And maybe these guys, Android specifically, has created a reality in which this isn't like I'm taking a break from my lucrative stand-up career to do like a little bit of a behind-the-scenes thing about who I really am.
Yep.
The who I really am behind-the-scenes stuff has way subsumed his comedy career to the extent that I don't even know if you would really call him a comedian anymore.
And, I mean, he does stand up, but
it's like that. It's like what we see on the show. Like when you usually, if you watch like comedians doing their podcasts on YouTube or whatever, like most of it is about like, there are some funny stories and stuff like that, but a lot of it is about the mechanics of comedy. A lot of it is about the business of doing comedy or just reacting to shit on the internet. And then when you watch their stand up, you're like, this is pretty basic stand-up. Like, this is pretty, like, the way I remember stand-up from, like, 80s and 90s. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? You'd first see an HBO special. They're going out there and be like, I'm wearing a black shirt and black pants, and my wife is crazy, you know? And it's like, that still is comedy for, like, 95% of people out there. And so it's fascinating to see Gerard have a career where the whole project is self. It's not like this is a side hustle or a left turn from anything. Like, the left turn is the map now. You know what I mean?
Can I say the most Andy thing ever?
Sure.
I might be completely misremembering this. My brain is now Swiss cheese off the LA weed. But it's like fucking Marc Maron. And I think Gerard went on Marc Maron maybe around the time of Nathaniel.
Maybe.
I might be misremembering it. But I almost remember them even kind of getting into a little bit of like, it wasn't heated, but a back and forth of like the structure of stand-up. Because Marc Maron obviously comes from
Marc Maron still goes to like comedy clubs and like does bits about his cats.
Yes.
Like, he's still doing like he does like confessional, political, whatever comedy, but then he still will get up there and be like, the thing about getting rid of your old guitars is this, you know, and like he just does jokes.
And Gerard, like a lot of his comedy is like, oh, I'm worried about what my mom's gonna say, you know, with this text. And he'll just like pull out the phone and read it. And there is a level where I think it worked so well in Nathaniel for me, because that is such a structurally tight set.
And conceptually cohesive.
It's cohesive in the way it's shot and all of these things where you're like, okay, this is a different version of what I grew up on with stand-up, but I like it. Where it's with the reality show, I'm like, it's almost like one knob too cute.
Yeah.
Where it's almost one knob where it's like, it's actually interesting when Gerard is talking about pining for men that I have no conception of. The minute that you reveal it's Tyler, the Creator, I'm just fundamentally less interested, because now it's like the complex headline industrial complex where it's just like, oh.
Like complex.com.
Complex.com. Yeah. Where it's like that type of headline where it's like, I already brought up Future and Drake, where it's like the first night that record drops, it's like, oh my God, look at what Kendrick said about Drake and J. Cole. And then when Gerard's thing comes out, it's like, oh my God, look what Gerard and Tyler, the Creator are up to. And I'm just like, all right, cool. Like, it's just, I'm uninterested in that.
Yes. That's like every single like video you come across where it's just like, it's just some guy at a junket whose job is to get somebody to say something about being cast in a Star Wars movie or a Marvel movie, whether they would do it. If they were, you know, if they're having cast, would you do it?
Kristen Stewart is being asked, would you be in an MCU movie? And now I have to see on my Twitter, like, Kristen Stewart only says she'll do MCU if Greta Gerwig's involved. Right. And I'm just like, this isn't even a news story.
Yes.
This is like a quip that someone's like, all right, man, the fucking clicks are about to come in. And it's, I also think what this show is illuminating to me, and I felt this way for a while, is that comedy in general, for I think honestly like the last 10 years, if not longer, has been obsessed, whether it's like on the more liberal side, the right side, of what can we say? What is the truth? What is reality? Because a lot of comedians, what they're actually fighting against is, what is the role of a comedian when a 15-year-old with a TikTok account is just as funny as me and had to put in 1% of the work? It's just, it's flattened it. So it's like Nathan Fielder, the thing about the rehearsal that was genius is it's like, all right, this guy is taking the auteur jump.
Yes.
Where it's like, oh, Nathan for You is funny, but now this is a guy who's working with the Safdie brothers after it. Donald Glover is a similar person where it's like, Donald Glover was writing fucking Werewolf Bar Mitzvah, Childish Gambino, whatever. Atlanta is a project of like, what is reality? What is the music industry?
Sure.
Who am I within it? Like, we're always looking, now we're looking for if you're that type of comedian to make the jump.
Right. And so is it, are we waiting for Rathaniel's? Are we waiting for Gerard's jump?
I think so. I think even when I was watching this first episode, I'm like, is this just going to be this? Or is something going to happen in episode 6, 7, or throughout this
that goes series? Like, or are you just going to hang out with your parents and keep trying to work through this, which is very, like, worthwhile, a really worthwhile pursuit, but is a very interesting proposition for being a worthwhile TV show. Right?
I mean, it's also the thing where it's like, what I want from Gerard's career, a comedian I have a lot of love for, might not be what he wants. And I mean, like I said, we're always, I think because it's so hard, we're talking about comedians now that broke 15 years ago at this point sometimes, where it's like, because there's less and less comedians, we're always waiting for like, oh no, what's your serious thing? What's your like Sandler with PTA? What's your Uncut Gems? What's that thing where I'm like, oh no, you're larger than life now? And I think for Carmichael, I thought after Rathaniel, I'm like, oh, he's going to write a movie. He's going to direct. He's going to do this or that. And he's like, oh no, I'm making a reality show for HBO. And just, this is, my mind is broken. We're talking about the normie conversation people have. I'm like, oh no, it just can't be.
But I wonder whether or not he does view this as like a more significant project than, like, because if Gerard Carmichael just wanted to constantly narrate his life, he could do it on a podcast. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And like, I would probably check it out, you know? But like most comedians have pods that update 2 to 3 times a week, where they're just kind of like going through what's going on with their lives. And a lot of those shows are really successful. And Gerard obviously wants to imbue his stuff with a degree of filmmaking and a degree of like artistic kind of contextualization and accent and stuff like that. Because you're talking a lot about the comedy part. The reality part is also interesting too, because I find myself way more kind of like fascinated by watching like Instagram or TikTok videos of dudes who are like truck driver brokers making deals with loading docks for their truckers in like 30-second videos where they're like making faces at the camera as some dude is like, yeah, I can't go any higher than 2,800, brother. And he's just like, you're still really firm on that. And like, that to me is like a almost like weird, awesome slice of life reality than watching this kind of like, is this fake? Is this real? Is HBO really putting this out if there's no like catharsis or resolution at the end? Like, what is this project? And I think one of the interesting things to watch in this show is the way in which Gerard obviously regards himself,
you know,
and regards himself as honestly like a flowering being, you know, like the way he dresses like himself and the way his stylist dress himself as he's like discovered this new part of himself and can finally like kind of be like, this is how I want to look. This is how I want to look at an award show or whatever. I want to wear these slippers and like is like feeling his body for the first time in a really long time. And like that actually is pretty fascinating to me that he's willing to do that and go through that on camera. It's almost more interesting to me than some of the family stuff at this point, I guess.
So I think a lot, and this is the thorniest
part.
Because
if you go back and watch 8, like this dude has really grown a lot since 8, you know?
Yes, but it's, and I see this especially like in the Black community almost, and you see it kind of with his friends when he's talking, and this is actually the thing that, while I'm not that interested in it, I get why people might be bumping up against this, where it's like, Gerard is trying to navigate, obviously, coming out, the homophobia from his family. But so much of his comedy now has cast his family in a certain light.
Yeah.
And you're like, is this a project that is giving his family a seat at the table so they can be humanized?
Well, I think that the show in future episodes probably will at least give them the opportunity.
Which, once again, I think is cool. But also, like, when I was watching with Daniel, I'm like, I don't necessarily know if I need to see Gerard's mom or the dad. Like, there was something about, I'm just like, this is one man's truth. And it's so interesting because it's not cutting back and forth to conversations or whatever. I'm seeing the world, or I'm trying to, through Carmichael's eyes. And the minute you make the proposition, well, we're going to do the reality show version, so you're going to actually see my parents, maybe say some homophobic things, say some things that are like very hurtful, whatever. I'm just like, artistically, that's far less interesting to me. It's because, to your point,
I'd almost rather watch the Grindr dates.
The Grindr dates was like, it was like, there were points where I was like, oh, this is interesting that Gerard is famous enough, he can't put his face on it.
Right.
But when these guys show up, they're like, they don't know who he is. Like,
they also don't care that there's camera crews there. Like, this is the world we live in where they're like, oh, weird, you're making this for HBO. Well, let's hang out. You know what I mean? You told me to come meet you at like wherever he's staying in whatever nice hotel he's in. Probably sounds like a cool date. You go over there and you're hanging out for a while. And it's like,
were these real men? Do you think these were actual Grindr dates? That's what I was trying to pick up. Because some of them I was like, yes. Some of them I was just like, it feels like you would have had to sign a waiver.
I don't know. The dude who like stuck, the guy who's like there the next day when he's getting ready for the Emmys, seems like pretty, like that seemed like a real person to me. I don't know. I guess I hadn't really interrogated the part, like how real this stuff was outside of the Beau performance art piece and the Tyler, like, is this literally like you guys texted, he curved you, and then now this is the first time you're talking to him. Like, that hadn't really occurred to me that the Grindr dates might be like casted.
And it's like, here, and maybe that's just broken podcaster brain, right? But there just was a little bit of, what is this show? Are you doing the Curb Your Enthusiasm version of the show? Are you doing the rehearsal version of the show? Like, what are
does it have to be one of those two things for you to be like a quote-unquote success? Does it have to be like something that breaks whatever the mold is of what he's doing? Because it seems like he is very sincere about like, the project is to see if I can find the truth about what is going on inside of me and with the people I love.
I mean, I'm going to be honest, it doesn't have to be Curb or the rehearsal, but I am very, very, just as a critic, kind of done with the whole celebrity, comedian, musicians are in this too, where it's like, yo, what's the truth, man? What's authenticity? Right. We're constantly being documented. Like, I'm going to just, I'll be honest, like, art about the social media age is so uninteresting to me. Art about reality TV or like phones and the internet, I'm so done with it. I'm just like, guys, we lost
the war.
This is
why most of our great filmmakers don't make contemporary films.
Yes, because I'm just like, I don't want to see PTAs like, this is my feelings on Instagram. I'm like, I don't care. am I being a hater?
I don't know how we're going to get around it. I think that there are shows and movies that effectively mix in. There will be no show or movie that will affect, like, truthfully document how much we use text messaging because it's so uncinematic. But it is honestly, like, I see it around me, like, probably, like, is it 60% of the way people communicate in the world right now? Like, it's not even close to being accurately represented in shows, especially when you watch, like, shows about teenagers and it's, like, you're watching somebody and they're just, like, on their phone briefly before they go on, like, their bike ride or whatever. It's like, nah, man, like, nobody is not looking at their phone right now.
I mean, but that's the funny thing, even with, and it makes art difficult, is like being single now. I'm just like, oh, I'm getting to the point where it's like so much of my communication is like coming through my phone. And I was just like, dog, why am I having this conversation via text message, right, or via DM? Like, this is the worst way to do it. And I'm just like, I bring that up because like in movies, I'm like, this conversation has to happen in person.
Yes.
You know, I'm not revealing all of this shit about myself
right.
in a movie.
But then
over
sometimes
text.
It's actually like easier to talk about yourself or talk about complicated topics in text than it is in person.
Yeah, because it's so like, it's like, all right, I can rewrite this sentence. I'm not going to rewrite it. Like, and that is sometimes, even when you talk to people now, like sometimes I've been going back in my mind where I'm like, oh, the way that I'm even communicating with the world now is so much different because we have learned how to be vulnerable in a very specific way.
Right.
And that's why I think comedians especially are so interested in this age, because like the things that comedians are actually giving you isn't necessarily the humor or laughter, it's the vulnerability.
Sure.
And it's just like, how do you be a vulnerable artist when we're just like, nah, I'm vulnerable through a brick phone.
Yeah, and I'm vulnerable all the time.
I'm vulnerable. Yeah. It's just
nobody's hiding how they're feeling anymore.
It's like, you'll be following somebody on Twitter or Instagram or TikTok. You like, damn, ma, you going through it. Yeah. Like, you just, and it's like, they're not even saying it, but you're just like, you've been posted a lot. Yo, some of your friends, you're just like, all right, I got to text him. He's crashing out.
Right.
In a way that it's like, when your friends used to crash out or used to fuck up, you're like, I wouldn't know unless we're like, all right, we're all going to the bar and like two drinks in. He's like, all right, man.
I'm dead. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I'm dead inside. Yeah. And now I'm like, it's hard because I'm like, that's what I think the Carmichael reality show is trying to get at, where it's like the truth that I think Gerard is trying to present is, how do I be a C-list celebrity that has come out and make comedy about it?
I don't think he's trying to make comedy about anything here.
You don't think he's trying to make the Tyler the Creator thing is one of the funniest things I've seen all year.
It's also like, but it's pretty, it's only because it's Tyler. Gerard is not going, I mean, Gerard is like very raw and deeply like vulnerable and so lovable in that scene.
But I saw it as the peak of humor. Like I actually saw that punchline and setup as I'm just like, this is a great writer's room idea.
Maybe you're right.
Like, this is because it's like, it works on me, like, at my age right now, because I'm just like, who is the only rapper and celebrity who could make this scene not as corny as it would feel? And I'm like, oh, Tyler the Creator, because the minute he walks in there, not only is he charming,
right,
but he's like, to your point, I'm like, Tyler the Creator's been on camera since he was like 17, 18 years old.
He doesn't know anything different.
He doesn't know, he like, no, like, I think Tyler, after I saw, whatchamacallit, what's the, Carmichael was in Poor Things.
Yeah.
You know, love Carmichael. Acting needs a little work. Versus Tyler, I'm like, yo, Tyler's been famous for so long. He walked in there. It's so naturalistic. I was like.
Yeah, it's funny. He commands the room with his facial expressions. It's really, he has a ton of presence.
It was weird because I'm like, I saw Nathaniel and I was just like, oh, like Gerard's going to run circles around. I was like, oh no, after leaving that, I'm just like, I kind of want the fucking Tyler the Creator reality show now.
I know.
I was like, when he was waiting for
Tyler.
Maybe
we just got to get the Nathaniel extended universe. You know what I mean? Get Bo Burnham in his ski mask, Tyler going around eating people's dinner.
So you didn't like this?
No. I thought it was really interesting. We are in the Emmy push of like, there's 12 shows out right now. There's just so much stuff on my plate. Both like, cause I'm like, oh, I want to watch this, or versus like, I feel compelled to like check this out or watch it, that I feel like I got it. I hate to sound like a dick about it. I feel like I got it and I don't know if I'm going to continue to watch it.
Is it kind of what happened with The Curse, where it's like, I was watching The Curse and there was a point where I'm just like, I got it.
Well, The Curse is different because The Curse, it was like, I knew in my bones and then just through the way people were writing about it, like, this something is going to happen.
Oh, I knew something was going to happen, but I was just like, you know, I can check it out in a month or so. And then the night I was just like, I didn't see anything. And I'm like, all right, I'm fucking crushing tape.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I don't know if, I think this show is going to be not an appointment viewing. It's going to be like, all right, I'm going to crush like 3-4 episodes just
after
in
the
case.
Fact. After the fact.
Something happens on that 6th or 7th week. And it's like, I feel, before we depart, give me the hard sell on a couple shows.
Okay.
Because I'm at the point where it's like, I got X-Men 97, Invincible, a bunch of other Marvel superhero shit coming out, but I'm keeping up with Shogun. You know what I'm saying?
Can I give you one that I think you would actually, if you get like a weekend to yourself and you're just like, I got nothing else on the docket right now. And we're in this really weird zone where like, shows, especially shows in their second, third season, it's like really easy to put them in the box of like, the people who like that show, but yeah. we don't have to cover it really in a certain way because it's not going to win any new fans because a lot of people are like, I don't have time to watch 12 hours of television to get up to where I need to be to start the new season or whatever. Tokyo Vice. Now, Tokyo Vice, I don't know if you watched any of it the first season. It was a little like, I think it was a little uneven because like there's the Michael Mann directed pilot. Then it takes a little while to get its sea legs as it's going, but it gets going and it's actually like really, really good. This second season, which was like 2 years after the last one came out, there's a couple of shows like that, like Outer Range is another one, where it's like there's been, because of COVID and the strikes, like such long delays of getting to the screens. But Tokyo Vice season 2 is fucking incredible. And if you just are like in the Japan zone and are like, I'm loving this, like I recommend checking out.
I've seen rumblings that season two is actually cracked.
I don't think you could turn on season 2 episode 1 and watch the like previously on Tokyo Vice and get it. So there's also just some incredible Yakuza stuff in the first season. So
all right, I'll do Tokyo Vice because you won me over. Shout out Justin Sales. I was supposed to finish The Gentleman. I only got halfway through because Justin Sales has been infected with the fantasy disease where he's constantly hitting me up. He's like, yo, you want to go to this screening?
Yeah.
And I was just reading my text message. He's like, yo, you want to go see The Samurai? But I misread. I was like, yo, you want to go see The Last Samurai? I was like, oh, it's a Sunday. Hell yeah. I show up. And it's like, no, this is like the French 1967.
Oh, Le Samurai.
Le Samurai.
Oh, it's incredible.
And I saw, and I was just like.
Yeah, Melville's one of my favorite directors, man.
I walk into the Egyptian and it's like, oh no, this is like American Cinematheque. This is like the premiere of the 4K restoration.
Yeah.
And I've like heard of this movie before, but I was like expecting Tom Cruise. And I sit down. You got Elian
Delon, man. Yeah.
And I was just like, wait, am I watching one of the fucking best films ever made? And I was not in the mindset because I was like, it's my first time at the Egyptian.
Yeah.
And I was like, dog, I got to get back home. I got to finish The Gentleman. And after I got to that, I'm like,
dude, I'm going to watch The Gentleman.
I was just like, bro, man, I was so blown away. I was not expecting it. So, but I had finished 4 episodes of The Gentleman, I just want to say. That's more of what we need.
It's entertaining as hell.
It's so, like, I know we can complain about the Netflix of it all, but it's like, you want to know the feeling it gave me? People are embarrassed of the shows that they used to watch when they were kids. I remember when Weeds was out, and the feeling of that show where it was just like, oh, something is happening in every episode, and there's just, like, something happens, there's a reversal, there's a new problem, and it was just, like, the craziest shit, and by the end of those seasons, I was just like, this is the worst show ever, but, like, I'm still tapped in.
Yeah.
And The Gentleman gives me that Showtime feeling of there's constantly, like, a new person.
But there's, like, a little bit of, like, a Netflix speed to it.
Yes.
Like, it feels like they're, even though the episodes are long, and even though, like, that Netflix just is like, here, you're already 10 hours behind. You're like, here's the season. Those episodes, like, you can throw on a Gentleman and just be like, that was a very entertaining 63 minutes or whatever. And just be like, you don't feel like you were like, I can't believe they're just dragging this out more and more and more.
I'm like, sucked in the more I watch it, where it's like, it does the good Netflix thing where I'm like, oh, I've watched 60 minutes of this, but it does not feel like it.
Yeah.
And there's all, like, if I'm like checking my phone and then I look back up, something dope has happened. And I'm like, oh shit, I'm locked back.
Gotta go back in now. Yeah.
Yeah. Where it's like a lot of show, like, I can't do that with Shogun. When I'm like, all right.
No, the Shogun has actually cracked something in the modern television viewer where I feel like I wonder whether there has been a show that people are more locked in on in like the last 5 years. I can't, obviously because of the language, but also because of the detail. People are like, I watch every single frame of Shogun, like, with fucking, like, put me inside of a deprivation tank. I cannot be distracted.
Like, it's dinner time. Like, I don't remember a show where it's like, usually, you know, I'll be eating dinner. I'm on, like, YouTube. Or it's like, I'll be watching something on Netflix and be like, yo, let me scroll through Twitter, whatever. It's like, no. Like, I'm like, all right, for this hour, I'm just watching this like it's a fucking movie.
Yeah.
And it's like, once again, because the slate has kind of been cleared by the MCU, the Star Wars of it, it's like, I'm falling back in love with the rhythms of TV, of having a gentleman type shit where I'm just like, oh, I'm about to go to
bed.
But
you just can't go see a fucking one of the like 100 greatest movies of all time on the side, because then you just, everything else gets blown out of water. Like if you go see Le Samurai and then you come back and you're like, well, should I check out Manhunt on Apple? Like I like Manhunt or whatever. Like it's just like, it's not fair any more than it was fair to be like, I'm watching, you know, like any show from the 2000s. Like I think that there was a moment where it felt like Mad Men and Breaking Bad and some of those like Sopranos and some of those shows were like punching at the weight of like truly great cinema in terms of like what it made you think about, how it made you feel, even sometimes how it looked. But like it is very hard still to go have like a really perfect 2-hour experience with a movie and then come back and be like, I'm on hour 4 of 11 of The Gentlemen.
I mean, but here's also the thing. You don't have to deal with this as much. JS, my Highland homie, he's always inviting me out to screens. Yeah. Go check out The Wedding Scammer. Anyway, quite literally, he'll be like, yo, you want to go watch this like 4K restoration of this like legendary movie? And I'm like, dog, I was just trapped in a theater for 2 hours watching Godzilla vs. Kong.
Watching animated.
Or the X-Men 97. Like, it's like, after that, my brain is such mush.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, I'm going to lock in on YouTube and just watch like a sushi master.
Yeah.
Just his day of prep. Like, that's the only thing my mind will take in. Because almost like, watching Le Samurai, I was like, to your point, it fundamentally changed my brain chemistry in a way where I'm like, I can't go back home and watch almost anything that's on my docket for work.
Yes. Yeah.
Because gotta, it's going to fuck up my vibe.
Clear the mechanism.
And I don't know how like Sean does it. Like sometimes like Sean, like, I watched all these movies and I'm like, how did you go and watch the MCU after that? You
know? Oh man, we should wrap it up there. I really, really appreciate you coming down. This was an awesome conversation. Charles, you can hear on the Ringerverse and all over the Ringer Podcast Network. Midnight Boys comes out like, kind of tied to whatever the episode
most
is, right?
Most Wednesdays. Most now Wednesdays. We're on Thursdays because of, you know, like X-Men 97, Invincible, season finale. Guys, tap in. Monkey Man. We're doing a Monkey,
oh, Monkey
Man,
Man I'm really excited for. I got Monkey Man coming up. I can't wait to see First Omen. You're a horror fan?
No, I'm... When I tell you, like, I am, like, I can't do horror, bro.
Right, I'm not even to describe some of the stuff I've seen then. thank you so much to Kaya McMullen for producing us today. And we will be back on Thursday. Expect Shogun, expect Top Chef, and then probably a little bit of previewing of Ripley on Netflix and Sugar on Apple TV. My guy Colin Farrell's back.